Hello and welcome to another edition of Kaleidoscope. This is Magda Zenon here in Nicosia, and with me from Beirut is one of my most favorite people, Abir Hajj Ibrahim. Welcome, Abir.
Yes, hello, welcome.
To introduce you to the listeners, you are a Syrian peace builder, a mediator, a co-founder of Mobad Derun, a pioneering organization dedicated to strengthening civic leadership and social cohesion in Syria. But you are so much more as well, because you have developed innovative multi-track approaches that connect diaspora dialogues at track three for community leadership. You've done stuff at track two and at track one. And you've also received a lot of awards. But I think the thing I find most unexpected about you, and is very enlightening, is the fact that is your personal journey towards Islam. Okay, and I think, if you don't mind, if you could tell us your personal story, but we will also mention all the wonderful projects you have done, including the Peace Architect Networks in multiple Syrian cities. So tell us who Abir is and where she started.
Yes. I was born, raised, and educated in Damascus, Syria. And I come from a middle-class family who have a very, they were very keen to have a very good higher education. I am the last daughter for a small family, which is father, mother, three children. I am the last one. And there was like 10 years between the elder and me, 11 years approximately. So I was born in this small family in Damascus, middle class family with lots of people who goes to college, to higher education, and they have a very good like a history in getting high degrees in everything that they do in education. At the same time, I come from this family who have a very good history, as my grandfather was like a trader, and he earned his all his income by his hand. So it's like independent family. So we did not he did not heritage a huge amount of money, but he did provide some heritage to his grandchildren and families. The ideology in my family at that time, mainly, it wasn't like a purely Muslim family, more than a secular one. Secular, but not believer. So they were with the line of Muslims, but it doesn't mean practically, they don't practice a lot about the Muslim Sharia and whatever, but they do have this kind of Islamic background when it comes to ethics. And especially there were a period of time where the communist parties came to Syria, and my father was more lean with the left wing than the right wing. My mother background also intellectual. My uncle were with the Communist Party. So most of our family is like a believer, but not with a practice Muslim, daily Muslims issues. So that was the trend in general. My mother, she did not wear a hijab. Most of my aunts the same, in both sides, mother and father. So there was not any clear Islamic commitment by appearance, even in my family. But in the same time, the women, where they get like a higher education, they get a support from the family, they do whatever they want, and it's like a freedom, it's a range of a freedom space for them. So in in late in the, at the beginning of my 21, I have taken the decision to start a new chapter of my life in France. My brother at that time was living, studying as orthodontist in France, and there was like a welcoming environment for me to travel from Syria to France and start the education there. So I started, you know, when you come to any country, first thing you do, you learn language. So I went to Language Institute, and I do remember the Language Institute that time. It was at the Normandy area, and it was like a very good language institute where people comes from different part of the world. We have like people who came from Greenland, from United States, from Switzerland, from Germany, all over. So it was.
And how easy did you find it to learn the language?
It was. I did start learning the French language in Syria in the center, the French cultural center. So when I went to France, it was like to complete my degree in studying the language.
It wasn't from the beginning.
Yeah. I started at the age of 18 to learn French. I did learn the English before that because I went to private schools inside the country, so I have a very good English language. But I complement my languages in the age of 18, starting with the French one. So when I went to France to study the French language, I supposed to join it's an international school language, and everyone came from different parts of the globe, and we started there. There was like a turning point in my life at that center, because eventually I was like coming to this center, my appearance did not give any indicator that I'm coming from the Arab world. This is one, and it did not give any indicator that I am Muslim. This is two. So the only way that the people knows that I am Muslims and coming from the Arab world is if I only present myself in this identity. So at the beginning of any conversation, everything went well till I mentioned that I'm from Syria and I have this Islamic background. Everything turned upside down. Even the way that the people looked at you, the way the people interact with you. But I didn't understand at that time, because the issue of sectarianism, or the issue of not accepting the others, it didn't come into my mind. I didn't digest it at that time. So I didn't understand why there was like a changing behavior once they know my identity and my background.
Well, it was the first time you came into contact with what discrimination means.
Yes.
And stereotype means.
Yes, exactly. And I didn't understand that this is a discrimination or even a stereotyping. And I said to myself, it might be like some cultural issue, and because we don't know how to talk better, our French language is weak, and this is the common language that we need to talk with. Then suddenly, I realized that there is a clear position against the Arab world in general, and against the Islamic world even more. And I didn't understand why. And for example, in lots of conversation that I did or dialogue with the students with me at the class, they were like blaming and shaming me of something. At that time there was the incident of Salman Rushdie, who have been attacking the Holy Spirit. I don't know, there was like a problem, and they were like blaming and shaming me as if I did the whole issue of Salman Rushdie, and I'm blamed of what he did and what his Iranian government did to him.
You were to blame for anything that was happening in the Arab world, in the Muslim world. It was all your fault.
Everything was my fault. And then there was something around how the Arab and the Islamic world are treating women and how vulnerable the women are. Then I said to myself, but it didn't happen in my family ever. In my family, we have an equal rights. And in my family, I didn't feel that there is something different between me and my brother. And even he used to iron my clothes from time to time. And he did take care of me in a very good way. And we were like equal. So I thought that it might be a wrong messaging coming from the Islamic and the Arab world to these people, where they have these bad assumptions against the Islamic women. And it kept happening, yani the dialogue, and they came against me. It kept happening each day, even from the school teacher, from the class teacher. And he said, she always, yani she was like, always, you know, you are women in Islam, you might be beaten, and you might have not any kind of rights to go to education. I was surprised to see all of these bad assumptions. And social activities. They did not ever invite me to any of their social activities. Any. We were around 22 to 25 person at the class at that time. Then I decided.
Sorry to interrupt you. They assumed that because you were a Muslim woman, you wouldn't be able to go, or they just didn't want to associate.
I guess they don't want to have any kind of relation. No, it's nothing about Muslim women. Because, yani, I told you at that time, I was like more than secular behavior, not like a pure Arab Islamic behavior. And then I said to myself, okay, I will break the wall and I will invite them to dinner. So I have invited all the class. I have a very good, well preparation to the dinner. Everything set in place. And then suddenly only four came out from 22. Only four. And we enjoyed. I do remember at that time that the German came, the Greenland lady came, the United States lady came, and another lady from Africa came. But most of the other classrooms, in the classroom, they did not come. Then I have then the four the four colleagues who came to the dinner. They told me that there was a big discussion about this dinner invitation among the students. And they were like laughing, you know, are you going to this Syrian lady invitation? And they were like kind of having like ironic words against this dinner. And these four people decided to come. So, and they were laughing on them that really you are going to have a dinner with this Syrian lady at her house. It was like, for me, it was a very surprising how people actually broadcast hate to others.
Exactly.
Simple as this.
How hurt were you?
It was very hurtful because I did bring a lot of food and I cooked myself and I have asked even my brother to go out from the house. So there was a lot of things that I have put in a place just to make my guest happy. Then I decided to move from the defensive corner to have a more dialogue around what does it mean to be an Arabic Islamic woman. So I went to the bibliothèque, I gathered a lot of information and started to study. I brought a lot of statistics about the domestic violence in France, the domestic violence in the Arab world, about the Islamic Sharia when it comes to women, about the level of divorce, percentage of divorce in France, and the level of divorce in the Arab world, whatever. So I gathered lots of data and information and start to put together a kind of a presentation. At the end of this course, it was supposed that each member from the student, each one of us, present a presentation about a topic that he or she chose. So I chose, my title was The Woman in Islam. And I mentioned that I am mentioning the woman in Islam in the law, but not in the Islamic world. And I started to bring like a kind of comparative, it was a comparative approach. For example, I knew that each three women, each one woman out of from three women beated in Paris, while in the Islamic world, the percentage was less. And among each two families, there was one divorce cases in France, for example. In the Arab world, it was less. So I brought a lot of statistics. And then when I started to have an interpretation between the women rights in the Islamic Quran and the women rights in the Human Rights Charter, I saw that there is a lot of communality in between, but nobody is mentioning this communality. Everyone is focusing on the issues which is different between the Quran and the Human Rights Charter. So I began to read, and I began to read more and more, and then I become I read lots of things about history, and it wasn't only the books or the authors who comes from the Arab and the Islamic world. I read also a lots of books which is written by Western authors. So it was for me like gathering lots of information. And at the end of this presentation, when I finished my presentation, there was a lot of argument, and especially when it comes, you know, yani we have something, and that was, it took a lot of debate in the classrooms around it. Usually, when you get divorced in a secular state or non-believer state, the woman gets half of the property of the man. This is like by law. So you got half of the house and half of whatever he's got. In Islam, we don't have this. But on the other hand, we have something alternatively to this, which is if you get divorced, there is a certain amount which you both agree on it before getting married. And you say, this is what I get in case we have a divorce. And
you have a prenup agreement.
Yes. Pre-marriage agreement.
Yes.
And in your pre-marriage agreement, you get whatever you want. If you ask for a house, you get your house. If you ask for a big amount of money, you get your big amount of money. And there is another thing that you do, that when you engage, you also give an amount of money which the woman decide what it is. You might ask for a laptop as a gift. You might ask whatever you want, gold, whatever. So there is a two kind of donation the men have to gift for the woman in the if you get a divorce or even if you want to engage with them. So in my mind, it was equal to the laws in the secular state that you get the half of what the man have. But in the same time, it's an agreement. So you get like a kind of an agreement. So that was like a turning point for me, yani, when they were having a lot of dialogue and there was like a big debate in the classrooms around this article in particular. I said to them, yani, what is matter is at the end of the day, the woman gets any rights. What is different that you give her half of his property And for that reason, there were a lot of incidents in Europe where men would not have any kind of marriage commitment, legal marriage commitment, because they don't want to be, they don't want to give half of their property, or they don't want this kind of commitment in the in general. While in the Islamic world, you do you put an agreement. Before post-marriage agreement, and then
a pre-marriage,
put it as a pre-marriage
agreement,
and you get it for, later on if you divorce. So it's at the end of the day, both women, they got their rights either by an agreement or by law, but it's happened at the end. So there was like a lot of argument around this. And I came out from this kind of this presentation by taking a decision to be more engaged in the Islamic laws and to read more. And I went back to my country, and the first thing I did, I wore a hijab, and it was a very unique experience in my family.
Can I interrupt you here? So the research you did for your presentation was an eye opener for you as well.
Yes.
Okay, so you learned a lot of things. There were a lot of misconceptions that you had believed, and when you did the research, all those misconceptions were cleared up.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. So you go home and you put on a scarf in a family that's secular.
Yes, and I have started to go to the mosque to learn more about my religious. And always, there was like a kind of comparison in my head between the human rights, which I know very well, including women's rights, and the rights for women inside the Islam. Hala, when I did so, even I did not have any kind of welcoming environment in my house. I do remember that I have a very big fight with my father. And he mentioned in one sentence that he have a daughter with a red hair, but he don't have any daughters with scarf or hijab.
And to just to let the listeners know, under her scarf, Abir has this gorgeous red hair, but only people that in private settings see that hair.
Exactly.
So he was very so disappointed.
Not only disappointed, actually, in a lot of cases, he stopped talking to me, and we have a lot of disputes. And not only him, my brother, everyone in the family. Except my mother, she was like doing something like a kind of mediation in between. And she said at the end of the day, if you believe in the freedom of women, she have the right to do whatever she wants. It's her personal life and it's her decision. So it was very difficult for me at the beginning, because I was like completely, the whole family are in the left side and I went by my own on the right side. I did look for a lot of peer support out of the family, because I couldn't find it inside my family. So I did have a lot of friends who suffered in the same way. And we did have a lot of dialogue around what kind of beliefs that we have and whatever. But I was so proud of myself that I took this decision by my own. And I took it after analysis and collecting data and have a belief in my heart. And I get a very good price after that I have applied to work. One of the things that my brother said to me, that if you ever dream to have a proper work in your life, forget about it, because now you will be disconnected from the international world. Nobody will talk to you. You will have a high level of discrimination wherever you go, even inside Syria, and you will never ever work in a decent company in your life. This is exactly what I have learned. I said to him, okay, fine with me. So I went, I started to look for a job.
Anyway, you had made an informed decision. Your decision wasn't based on peer pressure, on blind belief. It was based on on information. You studied the process, you researched, and the decision you made was based on information, which is the way we should all make decisions.
Yes, exactly. And even I did not have why I opened this conversation between myself, I opened internal conversation and dialogue around this issue because of the discrimination, because of all these people who came against me and they squeezed me in the corner and talked badly about my identity, which I am not even taking it seriously, you know?
Did you have a lot of friends did you know a lot of women that did the same thing as you? Went from secular?
No.
So you were quite alone?
Yes. And after that, I started to look for people who did have the same experience like me. And I managed to see a lot of people, actually. It wasn't only me. Then the next chapter, which I see that whatever my father and even my brother told me about, it's a nonsense. Because when I applied for my first job, I do remember it was a British media company in Damascus. And they said to me exactly that you have a very high level of experiences, but can you put off your scarf once you enter the company? For me, it was a very weird
question.
Request.
Yes, very weird.
Yeah, you know. But no, I said to them, no, they said to me, you know, it's a media and like a promotion and marketing, and we need to have like a kind of non-believers among us. I said to him, no, why you are choosing me if you don't want anyone putting the scarf? He said to me, but you have a very high level of a qualification. And even they did give me a very good job offer. I said to them, So I'm not going to put off my scarf because of your work opportunity or job offer. And thank you. So then I went to another company, which was an oil business company. And it was very surprising to me that I was the only one who were accepted in this company. And we were only three women who are wearing the scarf amongst another 70 employees. So I get the job, and I've got a very, very good job offer, and it was a French oil business company, and everything went very well. I did not have any kind of discrimination from the French people in this company, and the only thing that it stood against my career development, it was the competitiveness among the employee, but it wasn't anything related to the scarf itself.
But Abir, I need you to explain to me and to the people that are listening, why do we, and I'm talking about the Western world, or the look at a woman with a hijab or a scarf and assume she's restricted and she has no rights?
I guess it is the whole stories which we are focusing on. There is a kind of bad behaviors coming from certain countries, from certain people. But this is what we are focusing on. We are focusing only on two or three incidents where there were violations against Islamic women. But we are not seeing the big range of good living condition and good life that most of the Islamic women are having, you know? So it's like a focus in a narrow, tiny corner on what's happening wrong. Oh. And we are not giving the space of what's happening in a good way.
Tell me, what has this change brought to your life? Because it's taken away a lot of things, and the one thing it took away from you is your family.
It is my first battle in life. You know, in your lifetime, you get a lot of battles. That was my first battle who made me eventually a very strong, independent, free woman who do whatever she wants, regardless the community, regardless the family, regardless the limitation of work.
Your only guidance now is your moral compass.
Yes.
Okay. And what has it brought to you? It's brought you freedom.
It's about my freedom. It was my first battle for freedom.
Okay.
And frankly speaking, my father was not an easy person, you know. He was a legal advisor coming from military background. And then he moved to the legal, to become like a legal advisor for companies and corporate. But he wasn't an easy person at all. He was a very strong person. And all of his character. So it wasn't like an easy battle for me to fight against. It was a very difficult one. And I was only 23 years old, Yani. I didn't have any previous experiences in getting in these kind of battles in life.
Has the relationship amended or not?
Not really. In each occasion, there was most of the time, there was some sentences coming from time to time about how bad my look with the scarf, about how did I get this kind of bad decision. So it was like ongoing blaming and shaming. It didn't stop.
And there's never been any acceptance that this is a decision you made because
no.
you studied. Okay. Okay.
No.
I mean, the reason I find the story so inspiring is because of the preconceptions non-Muslims have about Muslim women. When you see the scarf, you immediately assume she can't speak, she can't make a decision on her own, she probably doesn't work, whatever. So it's very inspiring to hear someone speak about not only that little space of darkness in Islam, but the broader picture of what it gives to you and the moral compass it gives you.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. That's why you're my friend, because you've got a broad mind and you've got a good moral compass. I think that's the only
reason. Thank you.
But let's, because we have a little bit of time, you have so many achievements, Birmo. Which of your achievements are you particularly proud of? Except the fact that you converted.
It's nothing like in one or two incidents, but in general, I do think that I did achieve whatever I want as a free woman. This is the biggest achievement ever. I do what I feel I want to do in everything. So there wasn't any time where ideas were imposed over me. There wasn't any time where people have managed to direct my way. So this is the biggest achievement ever, Yani. I am a totally free woman in all its sense. And that gave me the space to take risk whatever I want and to work as a woman peace builder in a very sensitive area like Syria for the last 30 years. To come out from Syria and start a new and become like a kind of displaced person in Lebanon. But even though I didn't feel that if I am a displaced, that means I have more vulnerability. I always felt that there is an internal power which guide me and the free mindset that I've got. It's always helped me to get over a lot of obstacle in my life. And it wasn't an easy, huh? It is not easy to become a displaced person while you were very well established in Syria, have a very good work and work everywhere. And then you suddenly find yourself jobless, homeless, communityless. Mm. I don't have a community, supporting community. And you start all over again. So I think the main achievement that I did, that I kept my freedom to the maximum and I kept doing whatever I have in my mind that that it is a good thing to do.
Very few people can actually say that. That they've actually managed to keep their moral compass and yet achieve what they set out to achieve.
Yes, I guess it was like all the time guiding me, like a guiding compass. And there is something also that I should say. In my family and even my community, yes, there wasn't any kind of a hard or extreme Islamic beliefs, but there was a lot of ethics in place. Helping the other people, trying to find solution for conflict, having a very good relation with everyone, being generous in emotion and in money and in everything. So there was a lot of ethical issues in place in my family and inside my community. The only thing that I did, that I linked this ethics to the Islam. And I found evidence in the Islam telling me that this is a very good moral ethics that you need to stick to.
I have to say, Abir, when I hear you saying that, I hear myself, because I grew up in apartheid South Africa, and my father mm-hmm. supported the government then, because the government then allowed him to give to his family what he wanted to give. Mm-hmm. I'm the opposite end, because to me, if there's injustice against one person, it's against us all. But there were morals in place. There was compassion mm-hmm. in place. There was empathy in place. There was generosity in place. There was doing the right yes. thing in place. So even though yes. we used to have these strong arguments, and we used to have some really strong arguments, the moral compass was the same. And that's yes. what allowed... I just moved it I'd moved it to a slightly different place, but the basis, the essence of what I was hadn't changed because of the family I grew up in.
Yep. Exactly. And you take it with you.
Yes, you take it with you. It doesn't change. And I always say yeah. to people that despite the fact that I disagreed radically with my father and with the greater family and with the community, because everyone would say to me, why are you fighting for equality? You want to lose your privilege. And I used to say to them, dudes, are you listening to yourself? Mm-hmm. I want to protect my privilege. So I faced a lot of criticism, a lot of attack. And I will always say that despite them disagreeing with me, my parents were the wind under my wings. They wanted me safe, but they didn't want to guide what I was doing or what I was saying. They couldn't anyway. And I think the same is with you. They knew they wouldn't win yeah. if they tried to yes. change my mind. Okay.
Yes.
So I think yes. this thing that we actually, disagreement doesn't mean you have to be on opposite sides of the room, because in fact, your moral compass is what counts.
Yes.
Okay. So, okay, I agree with you. I mean, that's a very big achievement that you've actually yeah. done what you want.
I never ever victimized myself. I did not put myself in a victim position in the whole of this 13 years of hard conflict in Syria. Or even when I wear the scarf and I took the decision to be more committed to Islam, I wasn't like the victim of my family. No, it was, I am the powerful woman of my family that does whatever she wants.
Here again, a similarity, because people have often tried to throw the victim label on me because I'm a single parent. Now he's old, so I don't qualify. I had a few serious health issues, and they would talk about victims, and I'd look around the room and think, who are they talking about?
Exactly.
And I think to myself, you know what, yes, I was a single parent, okay, but I was a single parent that was living in a country that I could speak the language. I was in the capital. I had a good job. I had a boss that supported me. We were both healthy. So I used to say to yes. myself that, or even when I had my brain tumor, the first thought was not, I'm in despair and what's going to happen. I'd say to myself, I have a brain tumor in a country that has healthcare to which I have access. So to me, being a victim has never been part of who I am. and I will not let you put it on me. Away. I'm a solid human being whose moral compass is in the right place, and I think that's what stops you inheriting the victim label.
Exactly.
Okay, because you know the things that you've got. I mean, yes, life has thrown a lot of ugly things in your face, but when your moral compass is in place, and we have to admit that a little bit of education does help, but it's not always the most important thing. Your moral compass is more important. You can do anything, and you can retain who you are and retain your humanity, which we have lost,
yes.
Just by the way.
Yes, yeah. Yes, I fully agree with you. We feel lost.
We have a little bit of time. Do you want to say anything about Syria, or is it a big conversation, too big of a conversation?
It is too big of conversation. Yani, it is so big. But what I do want to say that don't you ever underestimate the woman in the Arab world or even in the Islamic world. Always see how they manage to survive and to achieve a lot of things. The Syrian women have been doing a lot of strong, courageous things during the last 13 years. And the Syrian women did have a lot of challenges. We are amongst ourselves as a non-believer, secular, or even a religious backgrounds women. We did have our divisions among ourselves, but the divisions we could handle and break it easily when we are a woman than men.
But I think, Abirmo, that the people that underestimate the woman in the Arab world are not looking at what's happening. Because you look at the Syrian woman, you look at the Palestinian woman, you look at the Afghan woman, you look at the woman in the Yemen. I mean, what is keeping their communities together, first of all? The most basic thing, what is keeping the family from totally falling apart beyond the extra work that they do, but the fact that they're still there, they still have look after their family, and I use the family in a community sense.
Yes.
So to me, the people that underestimate Arab women are not listening. They're really not listening.
Yes, exactly. Mm.
Okay, Abirmo, I always get inspired when I speak to you. And
thank you.
And I need to make a plan to come and visit you in Beirut, or you come to me, because if I shout, you will hear me. We are so close.
You could come whenever you want.
I will make a plan.
If you want, you make a plan and let me know.
Okay, I will. And I wish us both continued strength and continued focus on our moral compass.
Yes.
Okay. And have a lovely rest of the day.
Thank you. Thank you.
And to the listeners, we must all stay safe.
Yes.
Bye.
Stay safe.
The first trilingual podcast station of Cyprus, Island Talks. Open, diverse, free.